You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. There have been big changes in American religion over the last couple of decades. On the one hand, the number of people saying they're not affiliated with any particular religion has gone up. The latest U.S. religion census finds an 11% drop in religious affiliation, continuing an ongoing trend. A new report out today from the Public Religion Research Institute finds that 16% of Americans say that faith is the most important part of their lives. That's down from 20% just a decade ago. On the other hand, in some parts of the country, there's been a big jump in some faiths and congregations. Our next guest says those changes are very significant, not just for religion, but for our politics. He says both parties should be watching these trends because there's a growing partisan divide over faith. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a member of a congregation, have you seen more people showing up over the years or fewer at your place of worship? Do you see a political divide within your congregation, or is everybody mostly on the same page? Have you moved toward or away from faith over time? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Ryan Burge is an assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University. He's the author of the book, The Nuns, that's N-O-N-E-S, Where They Came From, Who They Are, and Where They're Going. His latest book is 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. He wrote about politics and religion lately for Politico. Ryan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob. Appreciate being on.
Give us some of the big picture trends in faith. You wrote a whole book about this, but could you talk about that rise of the nuns a little bit?
Yeah, so in 1972, about 5% of Americans said they had no religion on the General Social Survey. And in 1990, it had risen to about 7%, so almost no increase in a 20-year period of time. But from that point forward, from 1990 forward, it's just been a slow and steady march of the nuns. According to the most recent survey data, about 30% of adult Americans say they have no religious affiliation. Amongst Generation Z, it's even higher than that. 48% of Generation Z says they're atheist, agnostic, or they have no religion in particular on surveys. And we're getting very close now to the next generation being more nuns and less religious, first generation in American history to do so.
But as you write in your Politico piece, this is not every faith everywhere all at once. Where do we see religious affiliation on the rise?
So there's been a huge jump in religion in places around the southern border of Texas. So the Mexico, the Rio Grande Valley, places like Starr County, Maverick County, places like that. But also in places like Florida, there's been a huge jump. Most counties in Florida have a higher percentage of religious adherence today than they had in 2010. And that's really centered around Miami-Dade County, where obviously Miami, Florida is at. They saw an 11% jump in religiosity between 2010 and 2020. And that has huge implications for politics.
Let's get into this political connection now. There is a God gap, apparently, in how the public perceives the two parties, how the two parties reach out to the public. What is that?
So Joe Biden's coalition in 2020, his voting coalition, was 45% non-religious people. There's a very good chance that when he goes up for re-election in 2024, but definitely by 2028, the majority of Democrat voters in that election in 2028 are going to be non-religious voters. Here's a really shocking statistic for people. In the Republican Party today is 75% white Christians. America as a whole is right around 50% white Christians. So Republicans are 75% white Christians. Amongst Democrats, it's about 38% are white Christians. And obviously those numbers are dropping all the time. So what's happened essentially is the Republican Party has become the party of religious people, specifically white Christian people, Catholics and Protestants, evangelicals, people like that. And the Democratic Party has become the party of the non-religious, which we just talked about, but also the party of Hispanic Catholics and Muslims and Buddhists and some left-leaning mainline Protestants. So they're really kind of a menagerie of all these religious traditions, while the Republican Party has basically become a one-note on religion, which is white Christianity.
And that you listed some of the states where trends are moving the other direction, Florida and Texas, where we see in many cases some of the most conservative laws being advanced on issues like abortion or talking about same-sex issues in schools, things like that. You see a connection there.
Oh, absolutely. I think that a lot of let's take like Starr County, which is a little county on the Texas border, only about 15,000 people in total population. But the share of people in that county who were part of a religious congregation doubled between 2010 and 2020, which is really amazing if you think about what's happening to American religion nationally, to have counties where religion has doubled. And that's largely because of Hispanic migration from Central and South America. And when the Hispanics come to America, they typically are bringing their religion with them, which is almost always Catholicism. And a lot of them are culturally conservative. So when you hear, you know, politicians talking about, you know, LGBTQ issues or abortion issues, they're going to default back to the religion they brought with them when they came to America. And that's why you're seeing, you know, there's Starr County was Hillary Clinton won by 50 points in 2016, and Biden only won that county by 10 points in 2020. And I think a lot of that has to do with this Hispanic migration, religious Hispanic migration, who are being turned off by some of the more liberal policies pushed by the Democrats. And Republicans are driving this wedge too, saying like these issues of transgender and book bans are very important. And I think that was actually really effective messaging in places like we talked about Texas and around Miami, Florida, where Cubans are, who typically tend to be more conservative anyway.
Talking to Ryan Burge from Eastern Illinois University about changes in American religion, how it impacts politics. Well, Ryan, let's take things close to home for you and me in Midwestern states. What are the trends we're seeing? How does that fit into politics?
Man, the Midwest is, I think people are really shocked by this. If you look at the map, the places where religion has fallen off the most are rural Midwestern states. If you look at a state like Iowa, for instance, there's lots of counties in Iowa where religiosity has dropped by 10 or 15% between 2010 and 2020. Even places in Wisconsin, in Minnesota, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, these are really key states when it comes to national electoral politics. You know, when we talk about winning the Electoral College, you've got to win Michigan and Ohio and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. And if you look specifically at suburban counties, which is where really the politics of the day are being played out, they're more purple. Rural is red, cities are blue, suburbs are purple. If you look at the counties that became less religious in the last 10 years, they were much more likely to shift towards the Democrats. So I think that's really where this whole suburban religion is really undergirding a lot of what's happening in national electoral politics. And I think we could do a lot more thinking about what's happening in these suburbs. We're having a lot more racial diversity. We're having a lot more economic mobility. And what is that doing to religion? In places like the South, they're becoming more religious. In places in the North, they're becoming less religious, and that's having a huge impact on national electoral politics.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Westby. John, hi.
Hey, how are you doing this afternoon?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, John?
Well, I just recently retired. I'm a retired Lutheran pastor, and been in ministry for 37 years. And during that time, I've seen a lot of ebbs and flows. But I think in the past couple of years, it's even been more so. I told the producer that I have many concerns about this, but one of the main ones, when I tell people what my faith tradition is, I no longer use the word Christian, because that's been such a – I better watch my language. It's been taken over by Christian nationalists who has, in my point of view of following Jesus, doesn't act like Christians, loving kindness, mercy, and justice. So I tell people I'm striving to follow in the ways of Jesus. And I think, you know, when you talk about white evangelical Christians, you know, I'm not a part of that tradition. I'm certainly not a part of Christian nationalism. But what I have seen a little bit is a rise of the awareness of following Jesus isn't something you say, it's who you are, and it's always been the case. But it's really based upon, in my world, the prophet Micah, when he says, what are we supposed to do? Be John. Humble, loving kindness, and justice.
So, John, thanks a lot for the call. Ryan, you're a pastor yourself at an American Baptist, I believe. What are your thoughts on John's observations about what he sees in the Christian faith?
Yeah, no, John's hitting on something I think is probably the most important movement and change happening in American religion. We used to have a robust tradition in America called mainline Protestants, and those are people like United Methodists, Episcopalians, United Church of Christ. In the 1970s, 30% of Americans were mainline Protestants. These are people who were sort of moderate or maybe even left of center on certain issues. They you know, the kind of people who thought, you know, I'll go to church. I don't really believe in all that stuff all the way, but I also want to help my neighbor and be a good citizen, good member of the community. those kind of churches are an absolute collapse right now. For instance, the PCUSA, Presbyterian Church USA, used to have 3.3 million members in 1984. Today, they have 1.1 million members, going to have less than a million members in the next 5 years. And you're seeing that in all these mainline denominations. So now for a lot of people in rural America, you only have two options for religion, which is evangelicalism or no religion at all. And I think a lot of people want a third choice. Those third choices aren't existing anymore.
Thanks a lot for that call, John. Congratulations on retirement. Ryan Burge is with us. He researches religion and politics at Eastern Illinois University, looking at big changes in religion in the U.S., with more people saying they're not attached to a particular faith, what that means for elections in the U.S. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like one party or the other is a better fit for your religion or your belief system? If so, why? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Ryan Burge, author of 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. He wrote a recent piece for Politico on changes in American religion and why they could have a big impact on American politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Ryan, I want to ask about another demographic group we haven't talked about, Black Protestants. Do they buck the trend where more religious observance tends to equate to more Republican?
Yeah, Black Protestants are a really interesting group because they're very similar to evangelicals in a lot of ways. When you look at theological measures, like, do you believe the Bible is literally true? You know, do you think a marriage should be between one man and one woman? Those kind of things. But if you look at their politics, they could not be any more different. You know, 80% of white evangelicals voted for Donald Trump, but 90%+ of Black Protestants voted for Joe Biden. Now, what's interesting is you're seeing a little bit of cracking now with Black Protestants. The ones that are highly religious are moving slightly towards the Republicans. By slightly, I don't mean 10, 20 points. I mean like 5 to 7 points. And this is only a small sliver of all the Black Protestants, but it does seem like the pew gap or the God gap is really infecting every type of religious institution, not just like white evangelical churches, but also mainline churches, Catholic churches, and even Black Protestant churches. And I do think there's going to be a future where maybe 20 or 30% of Black Protestants who go to church every week end up being Republicans, and they're really kind of be driven that way because of wedge cultural issues like transgender, religious liberty, and things like that.
I want to talk about another wedge issue, abortion. And that doesn't always seem to map onto faith. And I've looked before the show at numbers on Catholic voters' opinion on abortion. Now, the Catholic Church as an institution, very, very anti-abortion, of course. How about Catholic voters?
Yeah, so 60% of Catholic voters are in favor of abortion for any reason. So that's obviously in opposition to the Catholic faith. Actually, the Catholic doctrine on this issue is what they call the seamless garment, which is they should protect life at all instances, including in the womb, but also they should be anti-capital punishment. They should be anti-physician-assisted suicide. They should be anti-war in most cases. And what's funny is almost no American and no Catholic lines up with Catholic doctrine on that issue. But they also don't line up with Catholic doctrine on the issue of contraceptives, too. I just did some data analysis and found out that almost 95% of Catholics have used condoms in their life, which is a direct contradiction of Catholic teaching as well. What you're seeing with the Catholic Church is a huge decline in mass attendance. That's really the big story with Catholics. In the 1970s, over 50% of them attended mass every Sunday, and now it's less than 25% of them attending mass every Sunday. I think what you're seeing is a lot of them are voting with their feet, as we say, right? And if you don't like what the Catholic Church is teaching on abortion or same-sex marriage or condoms, instead of leaving the Catholic faith, you just say, you know what, I'm not going to attend mass because I don't want to hear those things that contradict my own worldview. I think a lot of Catholics like the church, but they don't like those specific teachings on abortion or contraceptives, things like that.
We heard from Amy in River Falls, who couldn't stay on the line. She calls herself a recovering Catholic, and she says once she had her daughters, she realized the place for a woman in a lot of these churches is not how I want my daughters raised. Their worth is more than anything. Why would I take them to a church where they couldn't be a priest or a pastor? And Ryan, you and I have talked about, I think, Catholicism and Southern Baptist churches as well. Do we see divides when it comes to women and faith and politics?
Yeah, so just to make this point, most Catholics are in favor of female priests, by the way. If you look at survey data, that's clearly true. And actually, most evangelicals are in favor of female pastors. even female preachers on Sunday morning. So the data is kind of in opposition to what the institutions are teaching on these issues. I will make also the point, there are lots of churches in America that allow female pastors, a lot of mainline churches like we just talked about. What we're seeing, which is really, really interesting, is for all social science history, when we talk about religion, we always assume that women are more religious than men. That's been true for 50 years now and all the data we have. But if you look at the most recent data, like the last 5 years or so, and you look at the youngest adults, so like 18 to 25, what we're seeing is that young women are more likely to be non-religious than young men, which is a huge change. And I think a lot of it is this idea of, you know, no female pastors and this really kind of masculine Jesus that a lot of churches talk about now to try to win men back has actually pushed a lot of women away. You couple that with abortion, you couple that with feminism and all the other things that women are striving for and making gains with. I think they're realizing that a lot of churches they grew up in are probably not the most hospitable environment for women who want to move ahead and become leaders.
Sounds like another good conversation for the future. Ryan, in just our last few moments, I think your takeaway from your piece in Politico for both parties is ignore these trends at your peril. You want to highlight that in just a half a minute or so?
Oh, absolutely. I think that we cannot even begin to conceive what America looks like in 30 or 40 years when you see thousands of churches closing down every day. Who's going to feed? Who's going to clothe? Who's going to do after-school programs? Who's going to do prisoner rehabilitation programs? And I think politicians from both parties are not realizing how much American society is going to change. We do not have a good governmental social safety net in this country. Religion's been that safety net for a long time. And as these churches close, it's going to hurt Republican districts and Democrat districts as well. And we are not anticipating those changes. And lots of people, the last, the least, and the lost, are going to fall through the cracks, and we're going to be worse for it.
Ryan, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Absolutely.
That was Ryan Burge, assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University. His books include 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. He joined us today for a look at big religious changes in the United States and why they may have an equally big impact on politics. His piece on that topic appeared in Politico. We've got it linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Cheesemaking plants today are bigger than they've ever been, and bigger operations mean more waste products that cheesemakers need to manage, sometimes at the cost of millions of dollars. As Hope Kerwin reports, one Wisconsin researcher thinks this byproduct could do more and may even reduce society's reliance on fossil fuels.
Many of us know the nursery rhyme, Little Miss Muffet sat on her tuffet, eating her curds and whey. But what is whey? Well, it's a cloudy, yellowish liquid that's a byproduct of cheesemaking.
When you take 100 pounds of milk, you end up with about 10 pounds of cheese, and then the rest is whey.
Pete Condrup is general manager of Westby Cooperative Creamery. His plant deals with around 150,000 pounds of whey every day. He says it's always been a part of the cheesemaking process. As cheese plants have gotten larger, whey has become more of a problem. The largest dairy plants in the state produce several million pounds of it each day. They've invested millions of dollars to dry it down into livestock feed. That's a product they can make money from. But many plants are just breaking even, and some are even spending money to manage whey. That's where John Lucy comes in.
I'm a chemist, so I look at this as chemistry. You know, we can convert it to something else.
Lucy heads the Center for Dairy Research at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He wants to turn whey into the chemicals used to make plastics and other consumer products that are currently being derived from fossil fuels. He says the chemical building blocks made in oil refineries are holding us back from a greener future.
We've got to replace those, too, unless we want to keep using fossil fuels. So we're interested in making a whole bunch of these kind of basic chemistry kind of things.
On UW-Madison's campus, the center has its own mini cheese plant. There are stainless steel basins where scientists can experiment with small batches. And on a raised platform, large computerized vats mimic modern processing plants. Lucy says they recently purchased a bioreactor, which is a stainless steel chamber that can be used to ferment whey into different chemicals. And he says they already have many of the tools that are needed to design the process.
So a lot of the filtration, this is an evaporator right here. So you might want to evaporate out and remove water from it. All of these existing pieces we already use for the whey processing side. We could repurpose them, parts of them, for extracting valuable components.
The idea of finding profits in the waste product is nothing new for the dairy industry. Prior to the 1970s, local cheese plants spread way on farm fields as a type of fertilizer. But consolidation and stricter environmental standards made that less feasible over time. The challenge led to the creation of ultrafiltration, a process for removing the protein from whey to be used in other products. Today, whey protein concentrate is used for protein powders and other supplements, and Lucy said it's a multi-billion dollar global market.
To me, that was kind of an inspiration of, we can see something that was at that time a waste product and say, this could be used for something. We could do something with this.
John Umhafer from the Wisconsin Cheesemakers Association agrees that bio-based chemicals could be the next step forward in that evolution, especially for plants that can't afford to invest in the technology on their own and would benefit from pooling whey together at a central biorefinery.
Mostly it's an opportunity for the medium to small manufacturer, which is great news because it would be a new financial boon for both them and their dairy farms.
The new products could increase pay for dairy farmers. That would mean a lot, especially as the number of farms in Wisconsin continues to decline. Turning whey into plastics may seem futuristic, but Lucy says at its core, it's about letting nothing go to waste. He says farmers have long valued the resilience of making things themselves.
As a society, if we get back to kind of remaking all of it, not just disposing of it, I think people can get that story.
The dairy industry likely won't return to the days of small cheese plants and small amounts of whey. But Lucy says they don't have to maintain the single-use mentality that's led to large amounts of plastic and food waste. The industry can instead help build a better way. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a COVID-era policy prevented asylum claims at the U.S. border for many people. That policy ended last week, and the results haven't been what many people expected. We'll look at the end of Title 42 and what comes next. And you may have heard the rule, 10,000 steps a day makes you healthy, right? Yeah, I try to get 10,000 steps a day, but hold on. An exercise expert tells us there's nothing actually magic about 10K per day. We'll get some exercise advice, and you could join in with your questions, and you can get us started right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Are you like me? Do you try to hit that 10,000 steps per day? Are you really obsessive about it like me? Also, have you found other ways to just get that daily bit of activity into your day, steps or otherwise? Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we revisit U.S. history and the history of Wisconsin with the Native American author of a new book that tells the American story through the experiences of its indigenous communities. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin's suburban communities have been less reliable for Republicans in recent elections. A longtime political observer takes us on a tour of suburban areas around the state. First, a new book puts Native Americans at the center of the history of the United States. But that hasn't always been the way that story's been told. Growing up, I could think of three ways Native American cultures were usually treated in school and pop culture. One, they were ignored. Settlers just sort of moved into an empty wilderness. Two, they were treated as an obstacle to U.S. expansion. Three, more sympathetically, they were treated as victims of American expansion. In his new book, our guest re-examines that history by incorporating the stories of indigenous communities as active participants in that history and focusing on the interrelationships between Native peoples and European settlers and their descendants. He says you can't really understand American history without those stories. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about U.S. history and its indigenous cultures? What do you want to know about Native people's history here in Wisconsin? In a bit, we're going to look at some more recent chapters in Wisconsin history. Do you have an experience to share? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Ned Blackhawk is the author of the new book, The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History. He's Western Shoshone and a professor of history at American Studies at Yale University. He was on the faculty at UW-Madison from 1999 to 2009. Ned, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to quote here from your introduction. Here it goes. American history developed out of the epic encounter between Indians and European empires and out of the struggles for sovereignty between Native peoples and the United States. American Indians were central to every century of U.S. historical development. That, I think, Ned, sums up a lot of what you're trying to accomplish in this big book. Can you talk a little more about that recentering of our history?
I'm happy to. The new book attempts to provide a single volume interpretive overview of Native American history and does so, as you indicated, by looking at every century of American historical development and formation. And each chapter and the two halves of the book are attempt to ground Native peoples, their power, their agency, their resiliency, and their struggles for survival at the heart of the American historical experience.
And I want to talk about some examples in earlier American history. One case you make is that we can't really fully understand the development of the U.S. Constitution without looking at the interaction between this fledgling nation and the Native American communities that it was encountering. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Chapter 6 concludes the first half of the volume, and it's about the formation of the U.S. Constitution, the place of Native Americans within it. And as you suggest, it makes an argument, as do the other chapters, that these kind of quintessentially paradigmatic moments of American, in this case, political and legal history, are indelibly imprinted by the presence of Native Americans and the larger context of Native American history. You likely have learned at some point that the first government in the United States wasn't very successful. It's the Articles of Confederation, which governed the Continental Congress during the Revolutionary Struggle, was a disempowered kind of national political community or governing structure. I think I write somewhat playfully that the Articles of Confederation constricted more than they confederated. And it lacked the power that the eventual federalist system would develop through the constitutional government. The myriad ways that Native people shaped the formation of the Constitution are evident in the text itself. And so we could turn to the Commerce Clause. We could turn to the representational proportionment portions, and later to the 14th Amendment itself, all of which mention Native peoples or Indians. Indians are mentioned three times in the Constitution. And that inclusion reflects the centrality of Native peoples to the evolving concerns of the founders. And so one of the few areas of consensus that emerged out of the early deliberations within the Constitutional Convention in the summer of 1787 in Philadelphia was that there was a need, a dire, critical need for a stronger national government capable of handling interior diplomatic, military, and political relations with Indians. So the Commerce Clause has these kind of five, extremely important words that lodge the authority, that all the states cede the authority to the federal government to conduct commerce between the states and with foreign nations and with the Indian tribes are the five words. And that's just one example. The Constitution also upholds existing treaties, both made and to be made by the United States government, to be the supreme law of the land. And so treaties become, as you know, in Wisconsin, central elements of the kind of evolving doctrine of federal Indian law and policy that are struggled for and upheld and often reinterpreted throughout the territorial and state histories of many Midwestern states, Wisconsin included.
Talking to Ned Blackhawk about his new book, The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ned, I'm going to fast forward past a bunch of history to one of the chapters I got to admit I knew the least about, and it had a really important role to play here in Wisconsin. In 1950s, an effort to terminate the existence, the status of tribes in tribes around the United States. I want to start with a listen to Ada Deer of the Menominee here in Wisconsin talking about that Termination Act, speaking here in 1976.
Termination was a disaster, politically, economically, culturally. our rolls were closed, and this has a very drastic effect on Indian people. I remember one old Indian man in our traditional village of Zor telling me that one day he was an Indian and the next day he was not.
Ned, take us to the 1950s and this move in the federal government to toward termination, toward ending the status of many tribes around the country.
You know, I want to thank you for including that that segment there. I hadn't heard it before and look forward to learning more about it. You may not know that Ada was the director of the American Indian Studies Program at Madison when I was working there, and we worked, you know, together for many years. And she's recently released a beautiful autobiography that relays a lot of this history. It's published with the University of Nebraska Press, and it highlights this kind of dramatic turn in federal Indian policy that occurred in the aftermath of the Second World War and during the early years of the Cold War era. As she suggests in your segment, this was a disaster. This was like one of the worst kind of potential political decisions the federal government has ever made regarding Native American communities, at least in the 20th century. It was an attempt to essentially abrogate those treaty relationships I referenced earlier, to return essentially tribal communities over to states, where the Menominee, for example, her tribe became a county within the state of Wisconsin, and essentially to remove what was often called federal supervision. More legally, we would call it the federal trust doctrine, where the federal government holds reservation lands in trust and operates in partnership with tribal governments, the maintenance and welfare of the lands, resources, and communities upon them. So in the early 1950s, in 1953, the Congress passed a concurrent resolution known as House Concurrent Resolution 108 that legally terminated the political distinctiveness of Native nations. And each tribe, there were about 100 that got terminated, including the Menominee, who were able to delay the process a little bit into the early 60s. Each tribe essentially lost its standing as a reservation community. So what happens to tribal members? Well, the federal government's also going to subsidize their one-way migration or urbanization into urban centers through a program notoriously or infamously known as relocation. So these are the two national policies of the federal government in the early years of the Cold War, termination, relocation. These are assimilative efforts to disaggregate the jurisdictional autonomy and the sovereign authority of tribal communities, to assimilate their individuals into the body politic of the United States by sending particularly young families and individuals away from tribes to urban environments, and to erode a doctrine of federal Indian law and policy that dates back, you know, essentially to the founding, that had created bilateral treaty relationships between hundreds of tribes and the federal government, and also importantly, financial and other kind of federal commitments and healthcare, housing, education, and other kind of components. And so the Menominee, as you may know, have a longstanding, sustainable timber industry that's one of the most respected in North America. And it was heavily undercut and threatened by this challenging and difficult policy that came into being and lasted until the early 70s, when Ada, you know, very, very heroically and others led an effort to get their tribal sovereignty restored in the Restoration Act of 1973. So Ada's in the book. There's a nice image of her overseeing the Secretary of Interior as he's signing these restoration acts. There's a lot of that history that's conveyed, and I wouldn't obviously have really been able to understand it the way I try to without those years of experience back in Wisconsin.
Talking to Ned Blackhawk, author of the book, The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History. He's a professor of history and American studies at Yale University. Before that, he was on the faculty at UW-Madison, looking at the history of the United States and Wisconsin from the perspective of Native peoples, indigenous communities, and how they interacted with the U.S. government. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think that we focus enough on Native American history and its role in the wider story of the United States? If you're Native American yourself, are you seeing more of these stories getting told, more of this history being taken seriously in your own community and beyond? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Ned Blackhawk from Yale University. He's authored the new book, The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History. His book explores the importance of Native peoples and indigenous cultures to the United States and Wisconsin up to the present day. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Jonah is with us in Menominee. Jonah, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Jonah?
So I had a question about the Caribbean, the indigenous peoples in the Caribbean. So when European folks came over and colonized those areas as well as the mainland, throughout their history, have any of the Caribbean nations that still have been controlled by the U.S. over all this time, like the U.S. Virgin Isles, for example, have any of them identified as Native Americans? Where geographically are the cultural lines drawn?
Jonah, thanks for the call. Ned, you focus, I think, on mostly mainland United States here. Do you have thoughts for Jonah on Native cultures beyond the U.S. borders or, as Jonah says, in U.S. territories in the Caribbean?
That's correct. It is mainly a history of a continental history of North America, or at least the contiguous United States. Chapter one does explore the kind of initial phases of Spanish settlement and colonization in the Caribbean. And sketches some of the incredibly destructive impacts that early phases of Spanish colonial rule, exploitation, enslavement, and disease introduction had on the indigenous populations. These are some of the darkest chapters in the history of the Western Hemisphere and include the wholesale slaughter and often extermination of dozens of indigenous communities. Native Americans in those regions did survive. Many became incorporated into labor regimes, into various religiously organized mission communities and other forms of Spanish settlement society. And that survival has imprinted itself on numerous distinct, or there's been a distinct imprint of that survival within a series of Caribbean nations. In Puerto Rico, for example, the Taino communities retreated into many of the highland regions of the island and forestalled Spanish conquest for generations and indeed even centuries. It's also true in places of Hispaniola and other kind of more mountainous Spanish colonial regions. So it'd be helpful to understand the kind of distinct imperial regimes or nation states that eventually, or empires that eventually controlled these islands, because many were heavily exploited and turned into plantation societies, particularly among the English and French kind of colonial holdings across the Caribbean. But it's a really interesting kind of comparative lens to think about this history more broadly.
Thanks for that call, Jonah, at 800-642-1234. Ned, I want to look at another portion of the book now. And again, history I wasn't familiar with. Some of the first violence in the U.S. at the outbreak of the Civil War was actually militias in the West targeting Native American communities there. Can you share some of that history with us?
I can. And I appreciate that kind of opportunity to do so because, again, like with the Constitution, there's a big chapter, or at least an ambitious one in my own mind, on the origins of the Revolution in the volume. And there's a chapter on the Civil War that opens in the West and tries to lodge indigenous history at, if not the center of the conflict itself, as one of its kind of central legacies. Mm-hmm. Because the conflict between the Union and the Confederacy is you know, inarguably the crucible of American history. And most American history classes are, you know, divided in half or begin before or after the Civil War era. At least the survey classes of American U.S. history offered often in universities and colleges, like at UW-Madison, where we have, I think it was History 101 and History 102. And even AP history classes in the country often are up to and before the Civil War. So there is a, you know, just an incredibly vast, not just literature of scholarship on the subject, but an incredibly kind of set of developed understandings and paradigms for understanding this era. And they've kind of overwhelmingly failed to not just understand the tens of thousands of indigenous lives that were also lost during these crucial years, but also the legacies of the war itself. Because that's one of the major themes of that chapter and of the next chapter. Because the federal government during the war develops a capacity to do things that it had never been able to do. And so there's a series of examples, case studies, and even kind of anecdotes that kind of highlight this. One of my favorites is that when Lincoln was campaigning in 1860 and gave this famous speech in Cooper Union, New York, it took him 4 days and I think five different trains to make it to New York City from Springfield. And each train he traveled had a different size gauge, so that there was no kind of regionally united or national railway system. By the end of the war, and this is the opening scene of a few famous books on the subject, Lincoln, after his assassination, is carried slowly by train throughout most major northern and midwestern urban centers, and his coffin is draped and shrouded in black, and also travels at 5 miles an hour across a newly constituted railway system. So that image really just stayed with me as a kind of representational kind of frame for thinking about the dramatic transformations that the war unleashes, one of which is obviously militarily. There are roughly 20,000 Union soldiers in 1860. Nearly a million will serve on behalf of the Union itself, including, I think, approximately 180,000 African-American soldiers. Just to get this is a nearly exponentially larger military force. So the federal government is increasingly generating what we would think of now as the modern American administrative state during these years. And it's establishing federal funding and subsidies for not just national militaries, but state organized militias as well. And so there's been a series, or there were a series of campaigns already in existence throughout California during the long period of the California Gold Rush, in which white settler communities and their militias increasingly targeted and destroyed particularly mountainous and Northern California Indian communities. And once the war begins, then they start appealing for state and then later federal funding to do so. So I make a suggestion that these are, in fact, the first casualties of the Civil War, Indians killed by state militias using federally funded resources to enforce a new kind of property and political and kind of racial regime that will ultimately lead to, as is widely recognized in the field, the genocide of tens of thousands of California Indians.
Ned, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Ned Blackhawk. Ned was a UW-Madison faculty member for 10 years. Now he's a professor of history and American studies at Yale University. We've been talking about his new book. It's called The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples, and the Unmaking of U.S. History. He joined us today to share a history that centers around the experiences of indigenous peoples and how they helped to shape the Wisconsin and the country that we know today. Coming up after the news, suburban voters in Wisconsin have trended away from rock-solid support for the Republican Party in recent elections. We'll talk to a longtime state political analyst about how those changes are shaping statewide results and what's happening in suburban communities around Milwaukee, in Dane County, in western Wisconsin, and around Green Bay. And you can give us a report from your own community. Have you seen big political changes? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.